Thanks, Lance. And yeah, I'll invite Ed up as well. So Ed, just a little bit about yourself. You maybe tell us a bit about your family, what you get up to during the week.
I've got a wife and two great kids, which isn't bad out of three. My wife and I met at uni as love at first sight about 2 years after we first met. And we've been married for about 15 years now. We live just up the road. We've been in Perth for a little while now. And for a job, I get the wonderful chance to tell people about Jesus, mostly in high schools. And we run holiday camps and school groups so kids can come to know Jesus. I'd love to talk to you about that later if that's something that intrigues you.
Great. So, I mean, as I hop down now, why are you speaking on the topic of where do you belong? Where do I belong?
Yeah, I think because it's just so important to us. And as so many structures in the world where we used to belong, you know, imagine 500 years ago, you belonged to a little village, you belonged to a family within that village, you belonged to a church just by nature of being born in England, if you're like me, or in another country, similarly, you were part of a village, part of a family, part of a religion. Lots of those bits of society have broken down as we become both more national and more global. I do wonder whether with that, a sense of belonging has started to dissipate away. And so that's one of the reasons I think that's the topic for today, is that we do long for this thing that seems to be lacking in so many parts of the world. And, you know, when an election comes around, that's as people, you know, punch the ticket and vote for something. Again, in some ways, I guess we're voting for, I belong to this party, this idea, this thing, and that hope that when the announcement's made that this thing worked, that your vote counted towards getting your team elected, that there's just a little sense of like, yes, I belong to this movement that's going to change everything, and it changes nothing, and then there's political infighting and everything's the same, and we look for the next election, for the next thing to help us belong, and of course it all fades away, and the next cycle happens and things like that. So we do long for belonging, and it's interesting where you find it. Certainly my wife and I, we were working at a school in England near Oxford, and we wondered, hey, before we have kids, let's see if we should go somewhere else in the world. So my wife was from Cape Town, I was from England. We thought, let's go somewhere else. We looked at various places. We ended up meeting someone who's from Perth. She said you should come join us for Christmas. And we wondered whether, we came just for kind of a 2-3 week holiday, asking the question, could we belong here? Could we come and live here, work here? Grow a family here. This is back in about 2008. So as we came on a 3-week holiday, it wasn't just a holiday. It was asking this question of where do we belong? Should we stay in England? Or could we belong in this magical part of the world that we'd never heard of called Perth? And so we came, we stayed, and we found out amazing things that made us wonder, you know, how rubbish England was. Like in England, you know, you have to get out of your car to buy alcohol. But here, just drive straight through. It's unbelievable. You don't have to get out at all. You know, in England, we have bugs, but these bugs are pathetic. You know, you squash them and they die. But we discovered as we moved here, these little things called, have you seen these things? They're not little. They're the size of a Labrador and built like a small Volkswagen. You know, these things called cockroaches, right? These things are unbelievable. We don't have those in England. And as we encountered those, we began to think to ourselves, could we belong here with these massive tank-like operations moving around at night? I don't know why, my friend, you'd want to see at night. If you saw how many of these Labrador-sized Volkswagens are wandering around your home, eating your fruit and going through your fridge, you would not want to see it at nighttime. They terrified us. And so that was part of the challenge. Could I belong here? Yes, you don't have to get out of your car to buy alcohol. But there are these enormous, massive insects that will not die. You will drop a dictionary on them. And as you victoriously lift the dictionary up thinking, I've got you now, oh no, you've disappeared. And they've gone. You cannot be this thing. So we had this question, and we spent a couple of days in Denmark. That was beautiful. Had Christmas Day there with them on their farm, and into Pemberton and Margaret River, and back. Ah, it's wonderful. And we've lived here for a while since, and it's been just terrific. We love it here. But I guess what we're trying to do this lunchtime, as the Christian Union, is give you that 3-week holiday to the Christian faith. That we won't so much this lunchtime, though we have the last two, work out how do I belong to the Christian faith, but could I? What would it look like if I was to? And by giving you, hopefully, an honest tour, we'll show you the drive through our alcoholic centres, and we'll tell you about the cockroaches as well, in this one story that Jesus tells, to give you some idea of, look, could I belong there? And then the question will be, although we'll cover some of that, how do I belong there? That's the question you want to turn to your friend who's brought you this lunchtime. And say, okay, that does sound slightly appealing to me. I'd love to know more. How do I belong to that thing? And Jesus is doing that In this little chapter here, chapter 20, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, the four accounts of the life of Jesus. Matthew is the first one because it comes first. And it's divided up into these various chapters. Chapter 20, we're heading toward the end of the book of Jesus's life, this little biography of his. As we're coming, he's telling a story, and we know it's to the insiders, to the disciples, to show them what it will look like to belong to him. Because in the very first sentence, the kingdom of heaven. So it's saying, hey, this is what it's like when Jesus is your king. This is the kingdom of heaven. This is the 3-week trip to Denmark, Margaret River and Pemberton. Let's see what it's like. And so the invitation will come this lunchtime to say, hey, if your appetite has been wet by this passage, would you join us with Jesus as king to have and live and belong to the kingdom of heaven rather than just the kingdom of this world? And Matthew 20 does that by telling us a story. Now, if you've heard anything of Jesus, this story sounds like a mashup of all of his stories put together. There's some money, there's some vines, there's a master and some workers. It just sounds like all of his stories put in a liquidizer and served up as some sort of juice. But let's slow down a little bit so we get the story right. And it's here to explain what the kingdom of heaven is like, to see what life is like with Jesus as king. And it says it starts with a landowner, a master, a boss. And he sets his alarm at 5 in the morning. He's a big day ahead of him, so he has a hearty breakfast. He checks his watch and he heads out the door in plenty of time to be at the market for sunrise. 6 a.m., the first hour. Sunrise, the first hour as they did it in the olden days. Checking his watch, he's there. The cock crows, 6 a.m., and it's grape season. And he owns vines. So he's going to need some workers to pick these grapes and turn them into wine and other such things. And he agrees to pay them a denarii, a Roman coin, a good day's wage for a good day's work. And these men that he gathers from the marketplace, he sends them out to work, and the landowner sits in his office. He opens his inbox for the first time, and he has his first morning cup of coffee. 3 hours go by. It's now 9 a.m. And the landowner is back. Verse 3, sentence number 3, in the marketplace, and he sees some others standing there doing nothing. So he says to them, hey, you also, go work in my vineyard. There's plenty of grapes to pick. It's grape season. Let's go. And he says, I'll pay you, verse 4, whatever's right. So off they go. He's been there at 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock. 3 hours go by again, and the landowner's back in the marketplace, verse 3, seeing more workers. While the other workers are back at midday having their lunch boxes opened, these workers, who perhaps have just come from a cafe and they've had their morning cup of coffee and their croissant and they're wondering what to do for work, so they come in midday and they come and join him. So you've had the 6 a.m., the 9 a.m., the 12 p.m. Then 3 hours go by again at afternoon tea time. There it is, verse 5. More workers come along. And then the landowner notices it's 5 o'clock. It's 5 o'clock. He should be totaling up the profits. He should be weighing all the grapes that have been picked. He should be getting to zero inbox and checking that everything's locked up for the night. Instead, at 5 p.m., at the 11th hour, this is where the phrase comes from, at the 11th hour, he's in the marketplace one more time. And so verse 6, he asks the workers who are standing around, why have you been standing here all day long doing nothing? Well, because no one hired us, they said. Well, you also go work in my vineyard at the 11th hour. Now, this landowner, he knows his Bible way better than we do. He's read obscure books of the Bible we've never heard of. So he's read Leviticus 19 and Deuteronomy chapter 24, that you must pay your workers before the sun goes down so they can go home and feed their families. So at the end of the day, the owner instructs the foreman, the guy in charge, the boss, he says, hey, look, call all the workers together and pay them their wages. But begin with the last ones hired. You know, the 11th hour guys who've only been there for an hour. And go from then right to the guys who've worked for 12 hours, who are here at 6 a.m. Do it in that order. And so at the front of the queue, in front of the foreman, as he sits with his big bag of wage money, they all queue up, wondering what's going to happen. The last workers file forward with an outstretched hand. They're not sweaty. Their hands have barely touched the ground. They've hardly got any grape juice on it. And the question all the way down the line is going to be, how much is this guy going to pay? How much is he going to pay? Was it worth the work to work for this master? And in the open hand, it's very clean. These guys have only worked for 1 hour. The foreman places one whole denarius for 1 hour's work. Verse 9. And then the news trickles down, the whole workforce to the back of the queue. Hey, wait a minute, said the guys at the back. If he's paying one denarius for 1 hour's work, I've worked 12 hours. Now, one times, carry the three. Then he gets his app out and he's like, calculator. One times 12 denarius, that is unreal. So he quickly unlocks his phone. He's like, honey, I got work. I was in the marketplace at 6 a.m. He saw me leave before the kids got up. And I've worked all day. He's going to pay 12 denarius. Buy yourself a new dress. Book yourself a fancy restaurant. We're going out for dinner tonight, love. It's going to be great. 12 denarius, almost a year's salary in one day's work.
No, I love you too. No, you hang up. No, you.
All right. And then, and that must have been what they're thinking. Unbelievable, so much money. And as they excitedly shuffle forward to the foreman who's got the big bag of money with the wages, the first workers who've been there all day, 12 hours, they shuffle to the front of the queue to receive their pay. Expectantly, they hold out not one, but two hands, dripping with sweat from the heat of the day, grubbied with the soil and the grape juice from their labours. They expect to receive what they're owed, because verse 10, they expect to receive more. And in those open, calloused, hard-working hands, the foreman places one whole denarii. Well, verse 11, they begin to grumble amongst the sales against the landowner that they met in the marketplace 12 hours earlier. Hi, landowner. These men who were hired last, they only worked 1 hour, they say in verse 12, and you've made them equal to us who've borne the burden of the work and the heat of the day. Then to finish the story, Jesus says this. Looking at one of them, the landowner answers him, friend, I'm not being unfair to you. Didn't you agree to work for a denarius? Take your pay and go. I want to give the man who was hired last the same as I gave you. Don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? Or are you envious because I'm generous? And with that picture in their minds, Jesus moves from the story about these guys to his own friends in real life and says, so, that's what the kingdom of heaven is like. That's what it's like to have me as king. The last will be first. And the first will be last. That's Jesus's picture of living in this world with him as king, and that's what it's like. That's his 3-week tour of WA to see whether or not you want to come and live here and emigrate in the Christian faith. And I guess it raises a couple of points that's worth touching on a little bit deeper, a little bit further. The first is that it's last but not least. With Jesus as king, it is last but not least. In God's world, in his kingdom, the last workers are not the least. It's not about what we do, but what he has done. It's about God's gifts to us, not our giving back to him. Not our work, but his word. The parable, the story with a point, is clear. It doesn't matter how long you've served this landowner, you get the same reward. You may be last, but you're not least. And so the point is transferred over to God. With God, it doesn't matter whether you've been to church forever or never, whether you've been brought up with parents with some sort of faith, of any faith, or none at all, whether you know Jesus or use him as a swear word. If you thought that the see you here on campus was just people saying, I'll see you, as in like later, or whether you know this stands for Christian Union, however much you know about the Christian faith, that does not matter. Because if you're coming to this a little bit late in the game, if you're last, you're not least with Jesus. If you join Team Jesus and work on the vineyard, as it were, you receive the same reward as someone who grew up in a Christian home. You are forgiven forever, for free. You are loved into eternal life. It's the same for all, no matter what. And we find this hard because it works so differently to everything else in life. Everything else in life is earned. Everything else in life, it has to be given through a very clear sense of justice and fairness. Just imagine this, this kind of landowner as a game show host. No one would want to watch this game show. Where, you know, you've got 12 contestants, and one guy gets all the answers right, but the last guy, you know, when he's asked what's the capital of Australia, he says Sydney, which I'm still working my head around, and he gets all the questions wrong, but at the end, they all receive a car. No one's going to want to watch that show, because whatever they say, they all get the same prize. That's really boring. And commercially, this landowner, it's a bit of an idiot. This is not a way to run a business. If you're doing business and commerce here, this isn't the bit for you. A day's wage without a day's work. A day's pay without a day's pain. He's an idiot commercially. But when it comes to compassion, he's a genius. It's far more about generosity than justice. And if justice is all you're concerned with, there is justice that's needed in the Bible. But if that's all you're concerned with, the Christian faith may not be the place for you, because generosity is how things are dealt out here. Commercially, he is an idiot, this guy, but it's some way to run a loving kingdom of mercy and love, where the last aren't least. Think of that 11th hour worker. He's been in the marketplace all day, and it's 4:50 p.m. 10 minutes before the landowner will come and get him, and he's thinking about when he gets home. He hasn't told his wife yet that he hasn't got any work. He's going to be hungry again tonight for the kids. No clothes for winter that's coming soon. It's going to be hard. No family holiday that he promised them. No camping trip. And then he gets that the hour's work, but the day's pay. And he walks in the door, and his wife's joy is clear. Oh, you got a whole day's work, honey. That's unbelievable. A denarius. And the guy says, actually, no, honey. I didn't get a whole day's work. Well, where's the money from? Don't tell me you stole again. No, honey, I worked for it. He said, how did you get a denarius without working the whole day? He says, well, I worked for just 1 hour. And this master, I'm telling you, he's like no one else I've ever met. He paid everyone the same. He was very generous. He treated me like I was worth everything, even though I worked nothing. I was the last, but I wasn't the least. He's like no one else I've ever met. And there might be some sitting here now thinking to themselves, like the men in verse 7, no one would ever hire me. Seems like everyone else is already at the coalface doing the work, working for God, being good, being nice, and no one would ever come and hire me. If you knew me, you wouldn't want me working in your vineyard, God. I'm the least, so I should be last. That's what I deserve. The things I've done, the thoughts I've had, the way I've treated others, if you knew, there's no way you'd want me to come and work for you. But here is a God who doesn't dole out justice, but generosity. He does want you. And it's not about what you can do, but what he has done. He has done what is needed as he dies in your place. He's got life to give you, even though you feel like you're dying inside. And he's come back to life after dying on the cross. He's done the work so that we can now be put to work, to have a purpose, to be in the vineyard, being purposeful, working for this new master. And there's still room. This parable makes it clear. There's still room for more workers on this vineyard. The working day isn't over. So why not come join this master? He's unlike any other. Come join the team. The pay is good, more than we deserve. And the last and not least, it's never too late. And don't let your stubbornness or pride, like it did with me for so long, stop you from coming to Jesus. It did for Will as well, where he just wanted to win all the time, and so he wouldn't come to Jesus. Don't let that get in the way to stop you saying sorry for rejecting God. Instead, please have me. Please forgive me. Love me. Give me purpose. Put me to work, God. He's such a kind master. He'll never turn you away. You know, sometimes people ask, as I go and visit schools and tell kids about Jesus or uni students or churches, and someone will say, why can't I just become a Christian on my deathbed if God's so forgiving? And the answer from this story is, you absolutely can. You absolutely can become a Christian as you die. There's a famous story of a guy who did, right next to Jesus. He's no idea how he got into heaven. He just said to Jesus, hey, can you remember me? And Jesus says, of course. I'll see you soon. You absolutely can sneak in at the 11th hour. You can be last and not least when it comes to this kind of master. So why not come work for him now? You won't be least. But note, there is a moment when the wages are handed out, when the day is over. It's last but not least, but there is a too late and you're lost. There is an 11th hour when you can sneak in, but there's no 13th hour. There'll be a moment when either our time is up or the time is up. So don't delay. Why not join us in the vineyard? Everyone here has found the master to be good and kind. The pay is exceptional and the work is never too much and he's always there to help. You may be last, but with this king, you will never ever be least. That's the first thing I think we can see from this little story Jesus tells. Last but not least. And then the second big thing I think we can see is, look, this is what the Christian life looks like. It's work now, and you get the wages later. It's work now, you get the wages later. Since coming to belong in WA in Perth, there's only one thing that really gets me. I don't mind losing the Ashes and not being as good at sport, even though there's a third as many people here and whatever. And it's easy to do the, like, well, you're probably from convicts, even though not many people are. But it's the whinging pomp. Just call us that, and you know we hate it, because that's why you do it. Being called a whinging pomp is so annoying, and partly that's because, as someone who's British, you are trained not to whinge, not to complain, not to grumble. Jack Whitehall, the comedian, points this out. He says, you know, if something's wrong with the food and you're British and the waiter comes over and says, is everything fine? And your food is horrible and disgusting and cold and overpriced, you say, yes, they're lovely. Thank you very much. This is lovely. Because we're told not to grumble. Jack Whitehall says, you can actually hear English kids in restaurants being told by their mothers, I don't care about your allergies. Shut up and eat it. We'll use your EpiPen in the car. And that's a little bit what it's like. Even with that, that we're told as British people, you mustn't grumble. I still understand the grumbling in this passage. Sure, I rejoice with the 11th hour workers. Good for them. They get their day's wage with only an hour's work. But I also get the grumble in verse 11 and the complaint in verse 12. Hey, you made them, what? But we worked the, and the same? They made them equal with us. And so there's a complaint sent to the HR department of this vineyard. The wages should reflect the work, but it's in the Christian life. We want to give you the full tour. It is work now and wages later. It's not wages now and then nothing later. It's work now, wages later. And the landowner, in his response, is so annoyingly right when they complain and say, hey, look, this isn't fair. He says, have I been unfair? Verse 13, I've paid the agreed amount. You knew this when he signed up for it. He has the right to do with his money what he wants. He calls them to work. He says you'll get a denarius. Everyone else is told you'll get what is right. And they know that when they sign up. So they work and work and work. And then they get their wages, exactly what was agreed. So why do we find this so hard? Because in a knee-jerk reaction kind of way, we think that the last should be... well, last. That the first should be first. We think, and it's infected our every thought, that God, well, he sort of owes me. He's not that popular. He's not out there. He hasn't got a great social media presence at the moment. And when he does, it's often pretty lame. God owes me for the fact that I would dare to even think about him. And so when I'm going to work for him, it better be pretty fair. God owes me something. But God doesn't owe us a thing. Because look, if we choose to reject God and stay in the marketplace looking for a better deal, then we owe God everything. But if he's come and found us and put us to gainful employment, then we don't just owe him, he owns us. And if he owns us, then he owes us nothing. And so what we get to do now is have him as our master and do the work that is there. And focus on that, not worrying about the wages that will be paid later. We're just lucky to have a job. Now, we're used to work being part of the human contract. Our national anthem, I have now got my criminal record, Australian passports as you call them. So we sing the national anthem at our kids' primary school. It's the only national anthem I know of that has toil, work, as part of the song. It's also the only one with the word girt in it. but that's for another time. We're used to work without God being involved, but once we've toiled the soil in normal life, we just join it and we die. But with God as master, we work and then there's wages. It's good. And those wages are worth it. It's such different work. But we love to grumble. But in the Christian life, if you want to come and join us and belong, there's no looking round and putting tabs on who's been here the longest or worked the hardest. Unlike most of the rest of life, there's no seats reserved for those who've been the longest serving or worked the best or get the highest grades, or that we don't welcome it as enthusiastically because they've not put in the hours. If you think, like Will very honestly said just now, you can bring a kind of a worldly competitive nature to this vineyard, it's not going to be for you. If you think, here's a place where I can get ahead and get above and do better, now that's not how it's going to work, because God is a generous God. And how do we spot this in the wild? The passage diagnoses it as grumbling rather than gratitude. So, coming to work for this master, becoming a Christian, following King Jesus as King, leads to, it overflows from your heart to a life of gratitude in every area of life. And so grumbling is no longer part of our identity. Which lets us know, and we want to be honest about this when it comes to following Jesus. It won't always be easy, because grumbling is an option that we need to say no to. There'll be moments of grumbling, of work, of hardship. Maybe that is causing you to keep Jesus at arm's length, instead preferring to stay in the marketplace. Do you know what? I'll keep being a master to popularity or to work or to money or to my own needs and desires and my kind of mild narcissism. I'm going to stay there and work for that my whole life, and once I've toiled the soil, I'll join it. That's work as well. You've got to work somewhere. But I want to keep Jesus at arm's length because it looks like too much work. But the Christians in this room have found that actually, while there are opportunities to grumble, actually when we focus on the one who's invited us to work for him, we overflow with gratitude. Hey, look, if you've got the impression that we're a grumbly bunch, and we can be sometimes Christians, we're sorry. Someone's invited us to work for them, so unbelievably, undeservedly giving us more than we deserve, that we should be the happiest, funnest people around. Sometimes we're not, and we're sorry for that. But it does mean we are grateful. Yes, it's work, but there is a reward, a wage after the work, an eternal life that we don't deserve or haven't earned that now makes it worth it. Hey, look, I'm sorry if being honest has turned you off a little bit, but I do want to be. I remember the old day that I had when I went to university, 2001 in Exeter, and there's this big thing called the Freshers' Fair in England, and all the different clubs and societies are there, and you kind of pay £10, £20 to join, and they're offering that all they do is sell the best. And I know that because I ended up doing something with the sailing club and we would always just sell the best things. And the ski club had more members than anyone else on campus. Why? Because all they said was, hey, it's $10 to join or £20 to join or whatever it was. You get this free hoodie. It's not free. You just pay £20 for it. But you get a free hoodie and the opportunity to go on the university ski trip. And the word opportunity is so tricky there, isn't it? By opportunity, it meant you'll be added to the mailing list and told when the ski trip is. So you're basically paying £20 for a £6 hoodie that fell apart very swiftly. But they never told that bit. They never said, oh, by the way, the committee and all our friends, we've actually booked the whole ski trip out before we let you know about it. There's maybe two spots and no one's going to talk to you the whole time. I did go. That's not a personal regret. That's just what I heard from other people. They never advertised that. Hey, £20 for a £6 hoodie and an email that you can't actually answer to. No. They always put their best foot forward. Jesus is comfortingly honest about what it's like, and I hope we are too. Because what should the first hour worker really say? The guy who's been there all day, when he finds out the 1 hour guy gets the full pay, what could he actually say? What if his heart was overwhelmed with gratitude like a Christian should be? What might he respond as he is at the back of the queue hearing the denarius? He could say something like this: this master has done it again. He took me in and he's done it again. He's found another unlikely, unworthy, unlovable, unhelpful helper. Rejoice. My master is good and kind. He is to me. It's no surprise he is to them. Welcome to the vineyard, my friend. It's great here. And here's how we know Jesus is different from every other kind of master. It's there in verse 13. Have a look down. If you've lost the passage, have a look at verse 13 and see how different Jesus is as a master to everything else you will toil for in your life. People have grumbled in his face. They've complained, even though he's given them a good deal, more than they deserve. And they've whinged and moaned and grumbled in his face. And as he answers them, what does he call them? Friend. Friend, I'm not being unfair to you. God sees us as his friend. We don't deserve to be his slaves, yet he calls us and pays with the death of his own son to come and work for him, to give us purpose and meaning, and to do something with our lives that is valuable. And as we grumble in his face, he calls us his friend. That's the kind of master that you can belong to if you have Jesus as king. If you leave behind the marketplace where you are king and have him as king, all are welcome, no matter where you're from, what you've done, or when you show up. And when we do show up, and as we work, our king, our master, our new boss, he loves to call us his friend. So the invitation is there to come and join, to belong to Jesus.